What's that? Oh my God!
Every spring is a spring.
In the house.
Much has been written of the quaint, overtoned, ululational practice attributed to Central Asia called throat singing. Unfortunately, nearly all of it is based on a wholly apocryphal study written by a malcontent graduate assistant in esophageal music.
You wrote it, read it!
Esophageal music.
Thank you very much.
Whose research grant was eliminated during a mid-20th century economic downturn. In truth, which is such an unusual way for me to start a story that I'm already breaking out in hives, the technique was invented by Sundar Fez, an otorhinolaryngologist and recreational step dancer, while visiting Tuva, a republic in the Krasnoyarsk time zone.
Now, wait a minute. You did another visual pun. Our listeners cannot see that you wrote step dancer, S-T-E-P-P-E.
I thought they were watching us.
Not yet.
Oh.
We're not that famous.
Sheesh.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we were back in the Novgorod Sid. The Krasnoyarsk time zone. Okay.
Now, world time zone aficionados will recall that Krasnoyarsk time was previously known as Novosibirsk time. But in 1993, Novosibirsk Oblast changed time zones and since then has used Omsk time, thus requiring a new name for the time zone. Krasnoyarsk beat out its nearest rival, bloody cold time zone not fit for a yak,
yes!
By a margin of sixpence.
Or 6 rubles.
As late as the early middle 20th century, any Tuvan adolescent boy who wanted to advance to manhood faced a risky rite of passage. He had to stick his neck between the slavering jaws of a yak while the animal was pelted with senna leaves. And this was a live yak, not the comparatively predictable animatronic units that are employed in today's more politically correct rituals. Young girls, on the other hand, only had to score a 75 on a one-page multiple-choice quiz to enjoy the fruits and yeasts of womanhood. At one ceremony in 1951, Binoman, a lanky 14-year-old resplendent in manly regalia, had barely offered his neck to the yak when the animal sneezed, involuntarily biting down on and severing the poor lad's trachea.
I see a big, fuzzy yak story coming here.
Luckily, Dr. Fez was in the audience. The chain of events that put him there is too bizarre even for this narrative, but it does illustrate the role of the butterfly effect in chaos theory. Fez leapt down from his howdah, sterilized his hands in the bucket of Stolichnaya that had been left...
Oh, what a waste!
Nonsense.
Oh.
In the bucket of Stolichnaya that had been left out for the yak, and performed an anesthesia-free laryngectomy as the Tuvan Maturation Committee cheered him on. The operation was mostly successful. The lad could breathe normally again. However, the lack of a larynx compromised his voice functions. This troubled Binoman, as he had had designs on a lucrative career as county auctioneer. But Fez was undeterred. Having done extensive research on air compression, he knew that a person could learn to push air into his esophagus, then pull it back up with the use of a windpipe winch, a minuscule cartilage appliance available in any medical supply store. The resulting sounds closely approximated articulated speech. Sort of like a leopard closely resembles a button accordion. Still, Fez dutifully administered the teenager's throat therapy, and within a year, or 5 years really,
Binoman
could accurately adjust the fundamental frequencies of his esophageal grunts and belches so as to produce intelligible
communication.
But this was a far cry. And, in fact, many of his throat noises did bear a resemblance to far cries from the Dean Martin sound that the lad so longed for, and he fell into a deep funk. Actually, Binoman fell first into a deep ravine, escaping with only minor contusions. Then he trended funkward. Fez felt he had failed the primum non nocere. Is that close?
I don't know. That's what is that? You want me to do classic primum non nocere?
Oh, nocere. Okay.
Well, the old classical stuff.
Sure.
Yeah.
Precept he had learned in otorhinolaryngology school, so he devised a plan to buck up Binoman. By the time the next high season for manhood rites of passage arrived, the good doctor had amassed 20 kilos of ground cumin and chili powder, which he surreptitiously mixed into the bucket of Stolichnaya that sat by each ceremonial yak. Then he slipped into the audience, ready to spring into action should the animal sneeze during the ritual. Almost without fail, it did. Likewise, almost without fail, Fez executed an on-the-spot laryngectomy, after which he administered the same throat therapy that had worked on Binoman. Within a year, or 5 years really, 141 teenage boys were communicating in an eructational manner. Along the way, Fez had picked up a girlfriend, Iphigenia, who, thanks to a vivid imagination, likened some of the lad's guttural sounds to singing. This gave Fez the idea to form a glee club, the
Steppy
by
Steppy
Tuven Chorus, and he appointed Binoman its director. The repertoire was initially limited. A tabula rasa was more like it.
No doubt.
So the group did a lot of covers. But gradually, local composers began to write music that incorporated these strange new vocal timbres. One popular early song was
Bite My Yak, Bite My Yak.
Yes, a poignant account of the animosity many glee clubbers harbored toward the beast that irrevocably changed their lives. Fez was indeed fortunate that his real role in their changes of fortune was never discovered. Maybe till now. Although the chorus job wasn't as lucrative as that of the country auctioneer, Binoman grew to enjoy wielding the baton. After he added some flashy passados...
Fleshy passados, in this case.
Oh, yes.
Fleshy ones.
Fleshy,
yes.
Well
fleshy
done. Passados, voltes, and ripples. He'd learned from a mail-order fencing course. Audiences flocked to watch him conduct as much as they did to the groove of the music. And speaking of groovy music,
yes,
that is precisely what Calvos Ampersand Damien have in spades for you
in the house
today, added immeasurably by a musical visitor who has more than passing knowledge of the spawn of Fez and his consorts. So enough of this gay badinage, this otorhinolaryngological and sternutatorial piffle. Park your yak by the door and join K&D, plus the aforementioned special guest, for a couple of recreational hours
in the house.
Well, we are in the house. With Simon Wickham Smith today.
Wickham or Wickham?
I don't know. How do you do that?
Wickham
sounds Wickham to me.
Wickham.
No,
yeah.
Wickham. Be Wickham today.
Okay, Wickham.
No, no, why? Then be Wickham. That's so confusing. What is this that we're listening to? No, you may not. No, no, no. We're asking the questions. You may not. What is this? What? Please.
Are you trying to tell me that you do something like that every week? You actually sit down and write this every week.
Well, not that
one
particular.
One of us does.
Not that particular story.
Not the same one. No.
If you like, we could repeat that next week.
Great deal of research involved.
Yes.
Yes. Enormous research.
Oh, clearly.
Oh yes.
But, you know, I was thinking. Do you listen to the Goons?
We have
in the past. Haven't heard the Goons,
yeah.
Goons in
sure,
years.
And we
the
are
Goons and Monty Python.
Sure, we're true aficionados of the Python.
I can believe it. Yeah, yeah. It's like being back in England in the 1960s. But I gather, I mean, I wasn't really around them.
Maybe in the hyper musical sense.
So
that also true. Yeah.
So Simon Wickham Smith, you have a for a young person, unlike us, you have an enormous number of accomplishments, compositions, and this whole thing about studying in that area and translating. Would you give us a kind of a précis of your life?
Unless you've fibbed for your, unless your website is full of fibs.
No, my website is not full of fibs. Précis of my life. Maybe you would like to ask me questions about my life, so that, as to focus on appropriate areas.
For example, one quick question that comes to mind is, we were speaking the story over top of a tune which presumably was one of yours. What can you tell us about it? What was it and why?
Well, actually, as it was running, I was thinking it's extremely boring, in fact. But that might have been because of your words over the top. That's a piece that comes originally from a sample of a Jewish Kohen, a cantor, singing the first couple of verses of the Hebrew Bible. And then I manipulated and repeated and repeated and repeated and manipulated it some more. And it turns out as I think it's about 45 minutes of music. I just really like that. The original is quite different from what you get there, as you can imagine. It's about sort of 20, 30 seconds of singing.
Oh, you mean the canto, bit that you sample?
Yeah, the sample is originally about 20 seconds. It's just the first couple of verses of the Hebrew Bible when God is creating the world. And what you'll notice, it's completely random, but it's very interesting that the very, very, very last tiny bit at the end, when the music is fading out, I think, from what I remember, it says something like Ha'or Tov, which is, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but I think it means something like the light was good, or the light is good.
Either that or bite my yak.
Well, that also is possible, yeah, the sort of cross-cultural Jewish Tibetan piece.
Yes, oh, we're hearing something else now.
Now this is the end of it.
Thank you, very good. When it fades right down to the end, that's when you can hear it. We won't be able to hear it now, I'm sure.
No, it seems to be very quiet. Actually,
this is
the material we downloaded from your offering, your comment.
No, the archive site.
The archive site, yes.
Yeah, no, that's a real joy, that place. Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, when I first listened to that piece, I was listening very, very loud on headphones, and I could hear it. But maybe it's disappeared. Maybe the light is no longer any good. But particularly if it's on MP3, which is where the it makes it less focused. I'm not very good at explaining this sort of sound thing. But
focus.
Yes, let's focus on your early existence. How did you get into both music? Well, let's start with the music. How did you get into the process of composing, or did you come through it through playing? There's some stuff on it that sounds like you have a background in pop there, too, as well. So give a little background on who you are.
Yeah, right. Well, the music comes from, I think my original experience of music was really as a Catholic, going to Mass and hearing plain chant and
Jewish cantors.
And Jewish cantors in the Catholic Church are very few and far between. But yeah, no, I don't know where that came from. I think I just got into religious singing a lot. Anyway, so I was born as a Catholic, and I went to a very traditional Catholic Church. And there was Mass in Latin, even in the 70s when I was growing up.
Oh, it must have been very traditional because that Vatican II Council did the sort of native language thing.
Yeah. So that was the funny thing. In the church that I went to when I was a very small kid, about 6 or 7, there were these two very, very, very old priests. They must have been way over 200 years old. And they used, in fact, they, I think, had both been given leave by the local bishop to say Mass in the pre-Vatican II style country. Populum, where they're facing away from the I almost said the audience, the congregation. So they are facing away and doing and reciting the Mass without the people speaking. But of course, the people were speaking in the 70s. They were doing the responses. But I think the priests were so inured, the old Mass was so inured, the Tridentine was so part of them, that they couldn't actually manage to deal with the new Vatican II Mass. So they were given leave just to say Mass in this old style until they managed to die, which they did quite soon after, I think.
And 200 years was enough for them then.
Clearly. So, you know, they were doing the old Mass right up into the 70s. At least they were performing it in the same way. And so I got a very old form of Catholic liturgy. And anyway, so when I was about, I don't know, about 10 or 11, I became really fascinated by Catholic chant and by medieval music, because I got into the plain song and the Ars Nova in the sort of 11th, 12th century, no, even earlier, the 10th and 11th century in Paris, in the Parisian school, you know, composers like Léonin and Perrotin.
Sure.
And how they were dealing with the one-line plain chant and making and adding organum and slight dissonances, and it became fascinating to me. I have no
idea.
For our listeners' benefit,
yeah. Those who don't understand what this is, during the early part of the first millennium, the chant had been collected and brought together, and basically you had a group of melodies, and folks like Léonin and Perrotin were stretching the notion of how to work with it by adding florid sections we call melisma. And adding, in fact, a second line over top of the original chant in many places. So you had both a resonance and what came to fruition a half millennium later as a kind of a counterpoint. And so this was great ferment at the time, because it was quite different from what had come before with the monophonic chants.
Yes, I couldn't have put it better myself. That's great. Yeah, so that's what I became really interested in, and I don't know quite how it really developed from that, but I managed when I was two or three years later to hear on the British on the BBC a recording of John Cage's string quartet, at least his first string quartet. I think he wrote one just before he died too, and There are passages in that, and actually, as you may know, most of that piece sounds, sort of harmonically at least, really similar in some ways to this type of music. And I became really fascinated by this composer, and I went to the library, and, you know, there wasn't an internet then, and I went to the library and could only find like one reference to him. But somehow I managed to get more and more information. And then from that, I became also very interested in my mid-teens with the whole sort of post-second Viennese school development in the United States and in Europe. And
what do you mean by the post Viennese school?
Well, you know, composers like Earl Brown and Feldman, people who were using similar sort of harmonic language. I think I was thinking in terms of the sound of that age rather than in any sort of theoretical point that they might have had. So I listened to a bit of Webern and heard some interesting, subtle dissonance. And then I listened to Brown or Wolf or Feldman and heard what I thought was kind of similar. So I was making connections. Whether or not they were theoretically correct connections wasn't interesting to me at that point. And I became interested because, you know, I'd been brought up in a very sort of traditional musical background where, you know, harmonies were nice and dissonances were not nice. And I became more interested in the dissonance than in the harmonies. Or rather the dissonant, the formal dissonant, the harmonic dissonant rather than the harmonic consonant music.
That's grounds for excommunication, you know.
Yeah, well, it almost was from from my school, for sure. So, yeah, I mean, that's how I got into sort of post-Second World War music as a general area. I mean, it's such a wide topic, but it's like that was my basic trajectory into music that, you know, you could maybe sort of anti-parental music.
Anti-parental music, that's very good. Anti-parental in a different way from rock and roll might have been anti-parental.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I was really disinterested in rock music or pop music until I was about 17 or 18. I thought it was boring. I wasn't even interested in thinking it was boring. I just didn't listen to it at all.
And what happened when you were 17 and 18 that made it more interesting?
I don't know. I think I remember buying a cassette of the Sex Pistols, and I'd heard them before, of course, but I'd never listened to them, and it was just an extraordinary experience. And from that, you know, I just started to listen to all types of pop music and rock music. And, you know, from that one sort of pop, you know, like manufactured quasi-anarchistic point, I just went to look and listen to all, you know, all different areas of sort of noise and rock music and, you know, like sort of, I don't know, other more interesting sort of punk or anarchistic type of musics, like, you know, I don't know, Crass or Gigi Allen or Daniel Johnston, you know, alternative self-made musicians. I don't know quite how to describe it.
Well, it sounds like you went from an anti-parental disharmony in the non-pop world to a kind of similar not parental in this game, but anti-mainstream, anti-social. Yes, there you are. Now, did you have to resolve those two things? Because really, there's a distinct difference in character and in sort of historically between the post World War II generation, which we might think of as Beatles, and then the very edgy pop, which all has a strong beat sense. These are two very different characteristics. Now, how did you resolve those for yourself? And when did you, in the process of this, begin composing? And what was it like?
Right. Well, I started to resolve it by listening to Lamont Young and Glenn Branca.
Perfect.
Good jump.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And from those points, I went to from listening to Lamont's music, I went to listen, you know, to Terry Riley, who, I mean, you know, is absolutely straddles the pop and the classical in many, many ways, or the quasi pop and the quasi classical. And, you know, people early minimalists like him and Terry Jennings and early Philip Glass, early Steve Reich, people like that. And then Glenn Branca, you know, that took me to composers like, you know, the New York School, people like David Lang and Julia Wolf and people like that, and Rhys Chatham, and a lot along that trajectory, and Michael Torkey even, and, you know, those sort of composers who were working with the idea of pop music, but in a quasi-classical idiom.
And the question
and also Richard Maxfield. I discovered Richard Maxfield at a remarkably young age. Considering, you know, now he is only vaguely represented on the internet. I have really no idea how I discovered him at the age of 19 or whatever I was in 1987. But he made a very very great impact on me. I thought it was truly extraordinary music because I'd listened to a lot of electroacoustic and tape music by that stage, and nothing prepared me for things like the Pastoral Symphony or coughing music, whatever it's called. And, you know, it was just a really amazing experience for me to listen to that piece. And
now, we're talking about you now as in a kind of, or you're talking about yourself as kind of a passive role here as a listener. And how about when you started making it yourself? What was your trajectory in making music?
Yeah, right. Well, I'd never been interested in actually making the music until I went to university, and I met, on the very first day that I was there, I met the person who was eventually going to carry on right down to today with me along this path of strange music, this guy called Richard Youngs. And Richard and I, like I say, we've been making music for 20 years now, and to begin with, we just hung out and made noise. Really, I mean, quite literally, just made noise, and some of it was truly, truly dreadful.
Oh,
and
yes!
Some of it was actually rather good. He'd been doing things for about 5 years already, just playing around with tape recorders, and somehow had got the money together to put out some singles with a friend of his. And, you know, we just hung out and made music, and that's really what we've been doing for the last 20 years, less so in the last 5 or 6 years, but that's the trajectory really for me. And then in the late 90s I began to work with I got my first laptop, and then I started just making my own music. That's when I started working with samples and seeing what could be done with them and making the sort of music that I do now.
Let's listen to something that might come from that period. Sea Light? Can you give us an introduction to Sea Light and how it came about, and then we'll listen to it.
Yeah, well, I remember that piece. I can't actually remember what the samples were that I used, but I remember they were they came from a CD of jazz music, and I have no idea where I got it. I don't even know what it was, but it was sort of halfway between big band and sort of cool jazz. It was kind of interesting music, and I selected little bits from it and I struck them all together, and then I stretched them and created harmonies I think I wrote a little bit of a software program to change some dynamics and some to add some overtones. And well, the idea was really that I went down to the sea with a friend of mine. And there was this amazing light, and, you know, that's where the title comes from. But what I wanted to do was to try and create somehow in sound the vision that I had of this sea, very calm sea, and an extraordinary light floating on it. And it was and it was only after that that I remembered this piece that I had listened to very, very early in my musical existence, Light Over Water by John Adams. And it's utterly, utterly different. But somehow, I think I was maybe remembering the feeling of listening to that piece and sort of compacting it with my experience by the seaside. You know, it's all these very, very different little trajectories coming together in a strange nexus of music for me. I don't know.
Let's listen to it. Yeah, it's a gorgeous piece, it was written in 2001 by our guest here on Calvos and Damien
in the house,
Simon Wickham Smith. Sea Light, music by Simon Wickham Smith, our guest here on Calvis and Damien in
the house.
It says on his website that was written in 2000.
Well, I found it in a site that says it was written in 2001.
Which
coordinate,
is it?
Coordinate.
I have no idea. It's around that time. I think it might have been 2000, actually. But it's so long ago.
Oh, yes.
Huh.
For some people, 10 years is a long time. For others, it was just yesterday. As we go into our oblivion. Now, let's sort of put two more things in here. One that you mentioned just in passing was that you did a little programming to accomplish this. What's your background in that?
Oh, I taught myself. It's very mediocre, low-level programming. I have struggled for many years with SuperCollider, and I can do little bits and pieces with it, but I'm not a programmer. I find programming really, I'm a linguist, so it's really fascinating to me thinking about the language, but having to, learning a language, like learning vocabulary, is not very interesting to me. Similarly, learning how to program things that I'm not interested in programming is boring to me. So if I have an idea for something that I need to do that no other program that I can find can do, then I do it. Then I read the help file and see what I can do, but I'm not a programmer.
Our listeners may have wondered what kind of scientist you were that used a super collider, and I should mention that that is actually a piece of software with a wonderfully catchy name that is actually sort of a parametric-based modular way of producing sounds.
It's a very nice program. Yes. It does some amazing things, but it's incredibly hard, for me at least, to program.
So your programming knowledge came basically from utility. Is that how your composition and your language came?
The composition comes from that. But then also, my composition is really totally intuitive. I just sit down with some samples and see what happens. In 2003, I spent a year writing acoustic music, notating and writing acoustic music. And the result was some very pretty music, but it was so anodyne, really. And so I think, looking back on it, I was trying to replicate the music that made me feel good. Whereas...
The parental music this time.
Kind of, maybe you're right.
So you write about geese and humpbacks and ass breathing and plum petals falling.
Yes, that's right. The geese piece is actually a really nice piece. I'd like to get that performed, but it will never be performed, I'm sure.
You have a synthesized version?
No, I used to have a whole CD full of those pieces on MIDI, but I've lost it now. I've got no idea where it is. So,
can you hum it?
No, I'm not going to hum it. I can't hum an ensemble piece.
Have you tried? you're limiting yourself. This
well,
is an entertaining
actually,
radio show, and you're not helping.
Yes, if you could.
I know, it's dreadful. I have been known to walk around cities humming that piece to myself.
Well, there
singing,
you have it.
Singing it. Because it is a very pretty piece, but it's boring.
Pretty but boring. We've written
those. Yeah, pretty but boring, like so much.
Well, let's listen to two short pieces that are pretty and not boring. At Blackwater Pond and Sleeping in the Forest. Very short. Anything you'd like to sort of mention about those?
Yeah, the one thing I mentioned is that you need to play all three pieces because those two are two-thirds of one piece.
Aha!
So you need to play the other one, which is, I think, the snowshoe hare, which goes in the middle.
Okay, well, we have all three, so we'll play all three then, sure.
Yeah, you need that, yeah. Those are the shortest pieces I've ever done, and I think they're the best. Which is not very modest, really, is it? They are... versions of poems by Mary Oliver, And the way I did it was, I sang solo with my not very attractive voice into the computer, and each of those was then subject to, I think, another Super Collider program. And then over the top of that, I did some MIDI experiments, which were also chopped around and changed and slowed down and sped up. And then for some reason, I have no idea why, but they all work somehow. And the three together work really well. You know, it's really serendipitous. This is the first, this is really the first example of my just sort of sitting down and just singing and playing totally randomly and then manipulating that. Before, I think I'd had much more specific aims, despite what I said about working intuitively.
Was there a lot more material that you brought down to this length, or
no,
was this you
no,
just sort of worked
no,
vertically?
That's a really amazing thing. It's all there. Everything that I did for these pieces is there, and it's all somehow transformed. This is the first piece where I have really not discarded like 90% of what's been available.
Let's hear them. Three short pieces by our guest on Calvos and Damien.
In the house.
Simon Wickham Smith. Here they are. At Blackwater Pond, The Snowshoe Hare, and Sleeping in the Forest.
Full of lightning seeds. I slept By morning, I have vanished at last.